The most interesting guests in the music industry, entertainment, art, and politics step into the studio for Turning Point with Frank McKay.
This week on Turning Point with Frank McKay, Frank talks with author Peter Ames Carlin about his biography of one of America's greatest musicians, the legendary Bruce Springsteen. Peter had unfettered access to the artist, his family, and band members. The result is a startling, intimate, and vivid portrait of the rock icon. Let's listen.
And now, Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Welcome to Turning Point. Our very special guest today is Peter Ames Carlin, author, biographer. He's written many books, but certainly the famous rock stars that he's written about, and Brian Wilson and Paul McCartney, but most recently, Bruce. And that's the title of the book. Am I right, Peter?
That's exactly right.
And I hear it's wonderful. You're getting rave reviews on it.
Yeah, it's been going pretty well so far. I worked really hard on the book for 3 years, and the process was fun and exhausting at times, and now it's out and people seem to be reading it and connecting with it, and that's a great feeling.
You know, it's funny, I didn't say Bruce Springsteen. I assume everyone knows we're talking about Bruce. He has one of those names like Madonna or Cher. You really don't have to expand on it. Am I right?
Yeah, pretty much. He's kind of right up there in the pantheon of people who, you know, you glance at him, and you know exactly who it is. You know, just the way he carries himself, the way he holds his shoulders, you know, and throw a guitar, you know, throw one of those Fender Telecasters around his neck, and it's like gazing. It's like the McDonald's Golden Arches.
Yeah, well, yeah, no question about that. Where do you put him historically with some of the other, you can't even just say artist at this point. I mean, he's, whether it's an actor or whether it's a filmmaker or whoever, artist, mm-hmm. Where do you put Springsteen in a historic standpoint?
Well, he's one of those, I think he follows in the grand tradition of, you know, the voice, you know, the writers and artists and musicians who really kind of become the voice of everyday people in their moment in time. I mean, you can take it all the way back to Stephen Foster, the songwriter in the early 19th century, Mark Twain, Woody Guthrie, John Steinbeck, Bob Dylan. You know, the line just goes up and up and, you know, all the way up through history. We're talking about people who just managed to document, give voice to, and reflect the values and experiences of everyday Americans. And definitely Bruce Springsteen is that guy for this, you know, has been that guy for the last 40 years. And, you know, and obviously now, I mean, the amazing thing is at 63, he's going strong and he's, you know, he's touring the world and giving these, you know, incredibly energetic shows that people find so spellbinding, and releasing album after album after album of you know, what I think is very powerful and influential music.
Just a reminder, Peter Ames Carlin, or Peter Carlin, is our guest, and he is a biographer extraordinaire, and his recent work is Bruce Springsteen. Peter, getting back to Bruce Springsteen, I think originally people probably saw him, or maybe even saw himself, as being some kind of interpretation of Bob Dylan, and he's not really that. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, he was clearly deeply influenced by Dylan, as was every songwriter of that generation. And I think his first record, Greetings from Asbury Park, which came out in 1973, you know, that is probably his most Dylan-esque record, just in terms of how he's using the lyrics and sort of the sound of it, and definitely his look on the front and, you know, the back of the album from that period. But very quickly, you know, he's evolved into a variety of other kinds of, you know, facets of himself in a way. You know, you go through the sort of street poet type look he had, you know, in The Wild, the Innocent, and then the kind of motorcycle rocker, you know, in the leather jacket and the Elvis button for Born to Run, and the more blue jeans and white t-shirt working guy on Darkness. And it goes on and on up through, like, his, you know, the typical American guy look that he had, you know, the working man, his hero, in the Born in the USA era. And I think, you know, like, you know, when he writes songs or series of songs or albums, you know, that he takes on different kinds of voices, different aspects of voices. And, you know, and kind of portrays a character, portrays a, you know, a set of stories that, you know, that matter to him in that moment. You know, and so his style of writing has changed. I mean, and you've just listened to the new record, Wrecking Ball, and it's like a stew of all these different kinds of American influences. There's, you know, Irish folk music, obviously. I mean, you've got, you know, penny whistles and those sorts of rhythms and folk instruments. But there's also, you know, an obvious kind of electronic modern influence. There's like tape loops, sort of hip-hop beats. There's a little bit of a rap in one song. You know, and then there's straight ahead rock and roll, there's gospel, there's rhythm and blues, old fashioned, newer stuff. And it's like, but that's all him. I mean, this is the music that has always influenced his life.
We're with Peter Ames Carlin, and Peter, we're talking about Bruce Springsteen here, but what about yourself? How did you get into writing, and certainly how did you get into biography writing?
Well, I started, you know, I worked in my high school newspaper and my college newspaper, and writing always kind of just came easily to me, which made it fun. So so I ended up, you know, just sort of following that. After college, I fell into this job as a copy aide at the Portland, Oregonian newspaper.
You're a West Coast guy? You're a West Coast
guy? Yeah, West Coast guy. I live in Portland, Oregon now. Grew up in Seattle. And it just sort of, it just every step of the way. I mean, I just felt this passion, I mean, especially after I left school, that, you know, about writing. It just felt important to me and felt like something that was very fulfilling when you could do it. It was challenging to learn it and to do it, but once you've done it well or you're in the middle of doing something that feels just right to you, somehow to me that's, you know, as alive as I get.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, you know, in a way, so it's one of those jobs where, for one thing, you know, I felt like I was born to do it. For a second thing, I have no other skills. So that narrows it right down, too.
Yeah, well, you do this very well. When you do something very well, you don't have to worry about being a jack of all trades. Out of the three that I mentioned, Brian Wilson and Springsteen and McCartney, of course, out of the three of them, and they were all iconic figures, was there a favorite in research that stands out to you?
Yeah, you know, I think obviously it has to be the Bruce book, the, you know, Springsteen book, because, and for a variety of reasons, I mean, I felt very strongly about the story. You know, I had ideas and opinions and feelings that I wanted to explore and to learn more about. And, you know, and then one of the great joys of the experience was that, you know, even for the year and a half that I worked on the thing before I got in touch or you know, was approached by Bruce and John Landau, his manager, you know, for them to, you know, when they agreed to cooperate with me. The people I was meeting and the places I was going, you know, Freehold, New Jersey, his hometown, and then Asbury Park, and then among the, you know, the record business people that he worked with in at Columbia, you know, they were all wonderful, charming people, you know, really smart and funny and warm-spirited and just a pleasure to be with. You know, I've had beers with like the coolest people in the world,
yeah.
You know, and a lot of them are just guys who are contractors and, you know, and you know, golf course technicians and, you know, normal guys just around New Jersey. But they grew up with this guy. They played music with him for a while. And they're all very sweet, warm-hearted people.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
The relationship between Landau and Springsteen is unique, right? I mean, they've been together for a very, very long time, and I think the loyalty there is, it looks, at least from an outsider's standpoint, it looks unbreakable.
Yes, exactly. Well, there is a very, you know, the thing about them is that they really sort of complement one another because, you know, John is very business savvy. He's a very smart producer. He's got great ears. He's passionate about music, and he's also very savvy, you know, on the business side and very strategic about how to get things done and how to do it the right way. And part of doing it the right way, which a lot of managers and business people miss when they're dealing with artists, is letting the artist do what he needs to do. So sometimes that means becoming the biggest thing in the world and gleefully, you know, taking, you know, center stage. On the, you know, in the middle of the mainstream. Sometimes it means releasing an album that you recorded by yourself in your bedroom on a lo-fi, not quite functioning tape deck, which was what Nebraska was. But that's a beautiful, you know, what Landau realized was that was a beautiful album, that its flaws made it even more beautiful. And, you know, and it was a set of stories and a feeling that Bruce absolutely had to express at that moment. And so, you know, their relationship, I think Bruce obviously loves and trusts trusts John, and that, you know, values his input to a great extent.
People that I know, I mean, certainly I have mutual friends with Springsteen, they rave about him as far as being a friend, and they point to this idea of this loyalty. Is it something he prides himself on?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's enormously loyal. I mean, there have been times when...
Is it unspoken, though? Is it unspoken, or is it something that he, you know, brags about or whatever? No, I don't know, brags is the right word, but is it something he prides himself on?
I imagine he does. It's the sort of thing he doesn't really talk about much. He doesn't like to boast on himself. I mean, in some ways, he certainly does. But, you know, in other ways, you know, I think his commitment to his friends and in trying to do the right thing are very deep and personal for him in a way. So he's capable of being a wonderful friend and very generous and warm. I mean, and that's totally Bruce. But it's also Bruce to be, by his own admission, you know, a little narcissistic, a little self-involved. And sometimes, you know, and people are very upfront about this, he can be really surprisingly unempathetic to friends who, you know, need a small favor or need something. But, you know, in case of an emergency, if something big happens and you're in crisis, Bruce drops everything and he's by your side, making things right as they can be, you know, until the problem is solved. So, you know, everyone has paradoxes, and that's, you know, Bruce's to an extent.
I mean, I point to the idea that he's had the same band, relatively same lineup, for all of these years, and they've been together as a unit. It's a unique thing certainly in the rock business. I mean, you have people breaking up all the time, but for them to have kept such a close-knit group of guys for a while is, you know, I mean, is that financial? Is it just that it's convenient financially and they're not going to get a better deal there? Or is it something else? Do they have a tight friendship, those guys?
Most of those guys have been playing music together or, in you know, around one another since they were teenagers, you know, like 15, 14, 16 years old. And so you work that closely with someone, you know, with a group of people, as they did, sometimes under terrible circumstances, sometimes under beautiful circumstances, you know, gradually and slowly pushing and pushing and pushing for years until suddenly, you know, you wake up and you're the biggest thing in the world. You know, these aren't friends or colleagues anymore. They're brothers. You know, they've lived their lives together. They've experienced their lives together. And, you know, obviously, you know, brothers love each other deeply, and they fight like hell sometimes.
Yeah,
just given the nature, you know, the closeness of the relationship. And there's no doubt that there have been periods where, you know, Bruce has aggravated the band, or vice versa. They're not getting along so well. They have to take breaks and be away from each other. You know, and Bruce is obviously in charge. You know, the boss. They don't call him that for no reason at all. So a lot of what happens sort of through, you know, as a result of Bruce, you know, everything kind of happens on his terms. And so that's both fine because everyone knows how great he is as a musician and a performer. But on the other hand, it aggravates you after a certain amount of time because it's like, you know, dude, it's not, you know, this, my life isn't completely about you. So, you know, it's as complicated as any family relationship.
Is he easy to be classified as a control freak?
Oh, totally. But, you know, by his own admission, he, you know, because control has always been important to him. He grew up in a home, you know, where his father was manic depressive. There was a certain amount of instability in their lives. And Bruce, you know, as a child, I mean, he just couldn't bear it. He had to, and so when he became an adult, it was like he wanted everything wired down and he wanted it done his way. So he was always very controlled as a young man. He never took drugs. He never drank. you know, he only really started experimenting with drinking when he turned like 22, 23 years old. And he's been a very moderate drinker, you know, his whole life. You know, and so controlling his work, controlling his, you know, his art and his music and how he does things and with whom he does them is hugely important to him. And I think it's, you know, the one thing that he'll never quite let go of.
The Dylan influence is well documented, and you mentioned Elvis Button. Obviously, that's well documented. Who does he admire now, at this point in his life?
You know, I think, you know, like a lot of guys, I think he goes back to, you know, the music of his youth a lot. You know, the stuff he grew up with. I think he's also very, you know, I know he was he's a big fan of Against Me, the band. You know, they're sort of a punk band. Play really thoughtful, really cool songs, and now, you know, Max Weinberg's son Jay is their drummer, so it's all in the family.
Yeah.
You know, he's made it clear, you know, he's played on stage with Gaslight Anthem, he's played on stage with Flogging Molly. You know, he likes that sort of Celtic punk type stuff, and just good raw rock and roll, you know, and music that you know, that resonates in your bones.
That's musical. What about non-musical? Who does he admire?
Who does he admire musically? I think that, you know, well, clearly he admires the president, Barack Obama. He spent a lot of time, you know, supporting him. You know, there's all sorts of writers and artists who he admires. I mean, I think Philip Roth, he's a big fan of Philip Roth's work. You know, I'm trying to think what else he's been reading lately. But, you know, I think he just, it's sort of, you know, these are cards also that he tends to keep kind of close to his chest. But, you know, he's a deep reader. He's a deep thinker. He reads the paper every day. I think he likes good political commentary. He likes, you know, obviously he loves Jon Stewart quite a bit on The Daily Show. You know, I mean, anything I think that is sharply, intelligently, you know, composed that comes from deep in someone's heart is something that he's going to be drawn toward.
How much interference did you get from him, if any, about the book? Was he like, look, I'd rather you not put that in there, Peter, or can you hold back? And by the way, where would Peter Ames Callen, biographer for Bruce Springsteen?
He was exactly the opposite of interfering. He told me toward the end of the process, when we were talking about some final fixes or things that, you know, because I let him see the book beforehand, just, you know, for clarity's sake, and just to make sure that there weren't any major factual problems in it. He read it, and he had a few notes that were mostly dates and names and that kind of stuff. But his one major note that he had for me was, look, if you found anything along the way about me that you didn't use because you thought it would make me feel bad or embarrass me, he said, use it, put it in. I don't care what it is. And so I went through a short list of things that I'd kind of held back a little bit on, like pulled a punch. You know, if a certain aspect of him seemed to have already been illustrated and didn't need to go this extra step, I went through a few of those really embarrassing things, and he was like, put it in. And he explained later, he said, look, whenever anybody writes about me or talks about me like I'm some kind of perfect model of the, you know, you know, some sort of super heroic person, I feel diminished. You know, that's what he said. He wants to be perceived as a regular guy with, you know, an ordinary human being who aspires to be better than he is and doesn't always hit that mark. You know, he's failed his own, you know, he's failed himself and he's failed other people and he's aware of it, and he does not want to spackle over that part of himself.
We're speaking to Peter Ames Callen, biographer for Springsteen and several others. What did Springsteen say to you about your other biographies? Did he read them, first of all?
No. Well, yeah, you know, something that's sort of an open question, because Dave Marsh, who's a good friend of his and a friend of mine, and, you know, who I talked to a lot about my work, you know, in previous years and occasionally about Bruce, and he obviously goes back with Bruce a long time.
Sure.
He told me at one point years ago, before I even started this, that he and Bruce had a talk about my book about Brian Wilson. And, you know, and Bruce had a lot of opinions about it. But then I kind of tried to tease that out of Bruce, you know, when we were talking. And he never really quite acknowledged that he'd ever heard of it before, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I don't think Dave was, you know, there was no reason for Dave to come up with a fiction about what Bruce might have thought about my work. So it was just kind of, I felt a little curious. I felt like in some ways he kind of wanted to hold back from acknowledging that, you know, maybe while we were still in play, as it were. But, you know, I think he's also that, you know, again, he keeps his cards close to his chest. You know, I mean, I could sense that he liked something about me, you know, or something about the way I was pursuing things or something about what John had told him about me. You know, I don't know for sure. I mean, I have fun when I see him. He's very warm and sweet to me. We've had good conversations. You know, he's been attentive when I've had, like, small problems. You know, he's a great guy. I'm really fond of him as a person. But it's not like we're really close friends, you know. So, you know, I like to think that we're friends of a sort. But, you know, there were weird times when we were talking in very intimate terms about really, really painful things in his past, deep in his childhood. You know, and I had the sense that maybe even a lot of his closer friends had never heard these stories. But really, we were talking about it in a kind of professional setting. I was writing a book, he was being written about, and we were playing, you know, exchanging information or whatever and ideas, and he was being, you know, slightly wary because he knew he wasn't just talking to me. He was talking to me and all of my readers, you know, whoever they might turn out to be.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
The book is Bruce, and Peter Ames Carlin is the author, and we're speaking primarily about Bruce Springsteen here. What do you think Springsteen, at this point in his life, would like to accomplish that he hasn't yet?
I think that he wants to keep telling the story of what he sees around himself, what he's experiencing, what he's, you know, what he's absorbing through the news and culture and what he sees around him. What he hasn't done yet is, you know, he put out an album this year that speaks to the America of 2012. I think what he hasn't done yet that he really wants to do is put out an album in a couple of years that reflects and speaks some truth and poetry about America in 2014. You know, he wants to follow the next time he gets a notion to maybe try something different and, you know, make music in a different way, you know, make different kinds of sounds, tell different kinds of stories. That's his next goal. That's what he wants to do next in life and do it well, to the extent where even if it's a huge departure, people say, well, you know, not only is this still Bruce Springsteen, he's doing something different and he's doing it really well. You know, that there's something in here that touches me, that moves me. You know, I think that's what his ambition is, to keep doing it.
We're with Peter Carlin, biographer of Bruce Springsteen. Peter, I asked you who he admires. Who, for lack of a better term, who doesn't he admire or who does he dislike that's out there? And does he talk about it openly?
Yeah, I mean, he talks about it, you know, in the music, you know, and on Wrecking Ball. I mean, he talks about, you know, and he was, you know, when he and I were talking and having, you know, conversations, he was, I think essentially his problem is, you know, with people who don't seem to really be conscious of or that involved in their community. For him, the life is about connections. It's about connecting with other people. It's about being part of a community. It's about, you know, the world he described in the song, you know, Long Walk Home on the Magic album. It's, you know, this town, you know, this country, this place, you know, what really gets to the heart of it, it's a place where nobody crowds you and nobody goes it alone, which means that you're free to be yourself, to do what you want to do within the context of, you know, not hurting other people. You know, you have the freedom to be yourself in any way you choose, but when you have a problem, when your life is falling apart, there's a safety net around you. There are your, you know, the members of your community will step up and help you through the rough patches in life. You know, and that's what he admires. I mean, and that I think accounts for, you know, I mean, he gets on the new album, he calls out bankers and financiers and people who, you know, earned fat, you know, unfathomable amounts of money for themselves while everyone else were losing their jobs and, you know, and the economy crashed.
Again, we are with Peter Ames calling, and we're talking about Bruce Springsteen and his new book, Bruce, which is wonderful, and everyone that I've spoken to that has read it has just raved about it, absolutely raved about it. On the financial note, how is Bruce with his money? How does he handle his money?
Quietly. You know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, he's a very intelligent guy. He's you know, in his own, you know, life ways, his own habits, he's pretty conservative. You know, he doesn't do radical things. He's not going to make big investments in, you know, offshore banks or whatever. You know, he's going to play it pretty straight and close to the bone. So, you know, I obviously, you know, he's both, you know, lives simply. On the other hand, he knows he has, you know, a whole lot of money, and so he's free to do things and live in a way that most people cannot. You know, he can fly privately, for instance. He can pretty much go wherever he wants to go at any given time and stay as long as he wants to stay, you know, within the bounds of family and day-to-day responsibilities and his work. But in terms of his money, you know, it's something that sort of he keeps to himself. I know that he, you know, there's a lot of, you know, he's very involved in charitable giving, some of which you know about or we know about, a lot of which we don't. Because I think for him, you know, the spirit of charity is that you don't expect or want credit for it. You just want to do it. You want to help people. You don't need to be celebrated for it. And so, you know, he's happy to go out and draw attention to, you know, hurricane relief, food banks, you know, just trying to keep, to give the most vulnerable people the basic essentials of life. You know, I think that's important to him. And I'm, you know, and that's where he spends his money. So in terms of his own money, you know, I'm sure he's, you know, building his, you know, putting together, you know, a financial foundation that's going to help, you know, protect his family. But on the other hand, I think he's very eager to share it too.
Peter Collin, if we were to ask Bruce Springsteen, your latest subject in the book, Bruce, if we were to ask him what the turning point of his life was, or if he prefers, what was the turning point in his career, what would it be?
I think the turning point in his life was when he first strapped a guitar around his neck, you know, especially the electric guitar he got in 1964. You know, once he had that guitar and he could channel all of his frustration and anger and horror and hope into it, that was it. He found, you know, the keys to the universe, as he said once. It was music, discovering music and realizing that music wasn't just what he wanted to do, it was who he was. And, you know, you see that now. I mean, here's a 63-year-old guy who's storming around the stages of the world and playing for 3 hours minimum, and sometimes up to 4 hours, you know, which guys half his age don't even come close to. And he's doing it because, you know, he wants to give people what they, you know, something that they cannot buy, is what he likes to say. He wants to be, you know, transport them to someplace. And he wants to be, you know, and also he wants their energy to transport him, you know, because it's that, I think it's what he gets back over the footlights that keeps him, you know, that keeps him young and keeps him healthy and makes him feel the most alive.
Peter Ames Collin, the author of Bruce. In closing, Peter, where do you get the book? Where would you send people, or your website? What do you?
Sure thing. The book is available everywhere. You know, on your Amazons and BarnesandNoble.com and independent bookstores. And that kind of thing. It's also available in every bookstore you can find, I hope. And if you and for all that kind of connection information, you can go to my website, which is peteramescarlin.com. So it's all one word, peteramescarlin.com. And I got links for all the books and review, you know, and stories about the books and all kinds of other fun stuff, media, video, sound, and adorable photographs.
Peter Ames Collin, congratulations on the book, and really what is a wonderful career. Thanks for calling in today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Peter Ames Collin has been our guest, the author of Bruce and many other biographies, but go out and get Bruce. It's fantastic. Everybody is raving about it, and any Springsteen fans or non-Springsteen fans really should pick this up. Peter Ames Carlin has been our guest. Thanks for tuning in.
Turning Point with Frank McKay is brought to you by Herman Katz, Cam Jenny and Klein, Duffy and Duffy, and Gold Coast Bank. Turning Point with Frank McKay was produced by Out of the Box Studios in Bohemia, New York. Executive producers Frank McKay and Harry Oates. Director of Operations Corey Arnold. Audio and Studio Engineering Francis Kazmarek and James DeZigo of Sage Studios. Webmaster Eric Soule. Radio segment producer James DeZigo. Hotel and accommodations provided by Ohiga Castle Hotel and Estates in Huntington, New York. Transportation services provided by Mark of Elegance Limousine in Hop Hog, New York. Catering services provided by Windows on the Lake in Ronkonkoma, New York.